This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Yesterday, you might recall, we talked with Peach Lamp. He's the Chief Strategy Officer at Workday. We talked about digital transformation, the changing world of how we work. Well, embracing digital strategies, they are definitely everywhere, including a massive company best known for its industrial construction and mining machines. Tim, we are talking, of course, about Caterpillar.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. It's my 3.5-year-old's favorite company that exists. I mean, we're talking about the world's leading manufacturer of construction and mining equipment.
I've driven a massive Caterpillar tractor.
Well, you are now Arlo's best friend.
On their training ground. It was pretty cool.
Let's get to Augie Redzic, Chief Digital Officer for Caterpillar, who joins us via Zoom from Scottsdale, Arizona. Really great to have you with us this afternoon. Thanks so much for taking the time. When we think Caterpillar, I mean, we are talking heavy equipment. We're talking construction. We're talking mining equipment. I mean, in a sense, this is stuff that's powered by diesel, and it's kind of the antithesis of digital. But talk to me about how you guys harness digital.
Now, first of all, good afternoon, Carol. Good afternoon, Tim. I hope your three-year-old would like a little motor grader that I have behind me. my kids love it. Digital really enables Caterpillar. I mean, you know Caterpillar's history. You know, been around 100 years, kind of invented the track-type tractor and figured out how to put gasoline versus a steam engine and really kind of changed so many industries since then. We view digital as a big enabler for our dealers and our customers to continue innovating in the new world that we're building all around us. So, what we're doing, namely just my team, we have a team of about 1,400 engineers. We collect data from more than 1.2 million assets that Caterpillar has out in the field. We collect that data. We actually put the data in a useful information. We create services on top of that data, and then we pass information back to our customers so that they can operate their fleet better, so they can know where their equipment is, how hard it's working, and we have many interesting applications we give to our customers and our dealers so they can improve the operation of the fleet.
Well, you know what's interesting too, and I want to just, if I can, just step away from some of the digital work you guys are doing specifically, because you touched about data and how that, data is such an important part of what you do. And one of the things, Augie, that we love about Caterpillar is that you guys are so into collecting lots of data points. And if I can just for a moment, though, tap into what the data points tell you about kind of our broader world, our macro world, which has been a theme that we have been hammering in particular over the last week or so, because we look at inflation, concerns about growth, we're looking at the continued digital transformation of the world and how that can be uncomfortable as we move towards it. When you look at that, and you guys are known for your data collection and what it tells us about the global economy. So if I can just step back for a moment, what does that tell us about our world right now?
Well, obviously, we don't really talk much about data that we collect from our customers. We primarily use this data to help our customers with the applications that they use day in and day out. But certainly, you know, we have increased number of assets out there that keep collecting the data and leveraging that for benefit to the customers. And I can tell you that, you know, world is continuing to hum along. Our customers, we have growing number of customers using our platforms every day. So they extract more information from us. They use our autonomy solution, for example, more than ever before. So there's definitely desire and an appetite for data to be shared back with our customers in a meaningful way where they can actually leverage the applications that we built for them.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, you know, in terms of what's top of mind, you know, for your customers, you know, whether it's energy, transportation, construction, farming, which is you guys play into so much of what is our global economy, what is top of mind for them?
Well, look, I mean, the key for them is to be able to operate their fleet as effectively as they can. It's important for them to be able to get parts from us, from our dealers. It's important for them to transact with us in a seamless way. So when we look at the investment that we're making in digital, for example, we make investment to help our customers with condition monitoring. So we have a team of people that built very advanced machine learning tools that it can actually take information from, let's say, a mining truck at a mine, figure it out through vast amounts of data that we collect from it, that there's potential issue that may emerge over the next week or so. And if you can get in front of that problem with our customers, save them hundreds of thousands of dollars of unplanned downtime, and actually get the right part and the right service technician in front of the customer in that mine pit, it will be tremendously valuable to the customer. So they're looking at these digital technologies that we help deploy to them as a way for them to save on the operational costs, reduce the downtime. That's really important for our customers. You can imagine that each one of these mining trucks, it's tens of thousands of dollars per hour if it's not operational.
Right.
For the mining operator. But also, we make it very easy for them to get parts, to get service, to book service, to order parts online. We've just recently shared, we, through our dealers and dealer network, do more than 10 million part sales every day on our online e-commerce channels. And we expect that to continue growing. So you can imagine making it very easy for our customers to get their spare parts, to get the spare parts in the right moment, in the right time where they need them. And our dealers are there to help customers with that transition.
Hey, Augie, is this also playing into what's going on with climate change? And I'm just curious in terms of the data points and how is that maybe translating into helping out your customers digitally and ultimately leading to more growth for them?
Sure. I mean, a very simple way. We have a tool we call VisionLink. It's one of the fleet management tools. It's kind of de facto standard in the industry. This tool will tell fleet operators, for example, how much CO2 they're emitting. So it's very simple. If you obviously drill a little deeper, you can see how's your fleet doing when it comes to idling versus operating the engine. And clearly, if you have an idle time, you want to try to reduce it because of emissions that you're going to get with it. And also, you know, you want to just make sure that you extend the useful life of the asset that you have to the maximum. So there are tools that we develop in digital that actually help our customers operate those fleets more effectively.
Hey, Augie, what does this do for stickiness when it comes to customers and Caterpillar machinery? When they're ready to go and actually buy a new piece of equipment for mining or for construction, does having this digital offering, having the data about what they're working on, does that make them more likely to continue to buy a piece from Caterpillar rather than from a competitor? And what does the data show us about that?
I mean, absolutely. Total operating cost is what really matters to our customers. It is critical for us to make sure and demonstrate to our customers that operating cost of owning pieces of machinery from Caterpillar is better than from our competitors. If you look, for example, I mean, I'll give you some data. Customers, they come to us and start using our digital tools to buy parts, to transact with us, actually end up buying 24% than those that just do it over the counter. And not only do they buy more of what they previously bought, but they also have an opportunity to explore more of what we offer, and therefore they buy more SKUs, things that they haven't bought before. And they also have much broader spectrum of solutions that we can offer them when they see them in nice assorted digital catalog, for example. So it gives you some idea of how valuable we think these tools are.
Well, and talk to us about, you know, we've been getting into, Augie, how what you guys are doing can help customers, right, clients in terms of their digital transformation. How does this, though, the digital transformation that's happening with you guys and focusing on this, how is that translating into growth and how will it in the years to come on Caterpillar in terms of impacting top and bottom lines?
Yeah, absolutely. So I gave you a data point of $10 million in dealer part sales per business day today. We expect that will grow 50% in the next 3 years. That's one data point. Another interesting data point is we put a lot of effort and energy in our machine learning capability to give better leads to our dealers. So we use 20 different data sources, obviously data from machine. We look at engineering information. We look at telematics information, data from service. And we collect all of that, and we come up with a very precise recommendation to our dealers to go and visit a customer because we know that there's a particular need going to materialize in a moment. We just started that effort 3 years ago, really. In 2021, we did about $1 billion of closed won, so deals that actually resulted in sale, and we expect that in 2023 already we will be doing about $2 billion in sale.
But during... Excuse me, Augie, sorry, as we've been... seen supply chains just, you know, wreaked havoc upon during the pandemic. Did that type of data even matter? Like, did you have the equipment to send to those dealers?
We did. We actually had the best parts availability in 2021. So obviously, there's been a lot of hard work from many people. I know my team is, you know, went all over the world to find the chips that we needed and often had to replace them with different chips and then did the engineering work to ensure that these new chips will work as effectively as the previous chips. So there's a lot of effort that goes into it, but clearly, you know, when it comes to, for example, parts availability, which is what matters, 2021 was actually a pretty good year. Now, we continue to have challenges in supply chain, just like everybody else in the industry. I'm not at liberty to predict when those will get better. But again, we're doing everything that we can, and I think, are doing a reasonably good job.
Well, you know what, and just building on that, you know, in terms of digital transformation, you hear digital, you do think about semiconductors and chips specifically, and we've all had some really smart conversations and thoughtful conversations about where we need to be manufacturing, where we need to get our supplies, and we are increasingly hearing, certainly from a U.S. story, mm-hmm. that it needs to be closer to home. And you guys sell, I think, was it roughly about $22 billion in North America, and then I think more than that outside of North America. So when you think about where those supply chains need to be, does it make sense? We talked with the mayor of Columbus, Ohio, Intel making a big investment in that city specifically to build out a semiconductor presence. Is it really smart? Do you agree that we need to be building this closer to where we're selling and for the United States to kind of step up and bring production home?
Well, ultimately, you know, I'm probably not the expert to tell you where the factories should be, but I can tell you that.
But you buy, you need to have access, right?
It's critical for us to have access to chips, absolutely. And if that means that we need to do more in the United States, absolutely, we'll be fully supportive of that. But right now, I mean, we're still years away from anything in Ohio coming online. We still have, you know, short-term issues that we need to resolve, and those chips need to come from somewhere else.
Well, I have to say, it's great to check in with you. A few years ago, I did a deep dive on the company, spent some time in the proving ground out in Illinois. I got to drive some vehicle, a tractor. But it's interesting in terms of how this company, you know, continues to embrace technology, including the digital world, the digital transformation. It makes sense whether they're doing it internally or for their customers.
Why don't we do a remote where we do this from the tractor?
I loved it, man. Wear a hard
hat.
That's
pretty cool.
Self-driving tractors so that you can go to tough mining areas so you don't put people at risk. It's pretty amazing. Augie Redzik, he is Chief Digital Officer over at Caterpillar, joining us via Zoom from Scottsdale, Arizona. Coming up, we're checking in with Steve Case, talking more transformation.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the World Health Organization out with some new research, what they call invisible numbers, about the impact of non-communicable diseases, what to do about them. NCDs, Tim, you're talking about cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, chronic respiratory diseases, along with mental health. They all together under that NCD umbrella cause nearly three quarters of deaths in the world. The impact on quality of life, the global economy, and global productivity, it's really massive. So we're going to take kind of a look at the healthcare space, the cost, especially when you think about things like higher inflation, factoring that in.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that inflation element, because we know that healthcare is a significant portion of GDP here in the U.S., about 20%. What does it mean when everyone's paying higher prices for things? For that, we turn to Eileen Flick. She's Senior Vice President and Director of Health Technical Services at Siegel. It's a benefits and HR consulting firm. Eileen, great to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, talk to us a little bit about some of the data that Carol just shared and the idea of, obviously, these are preventable diseases in many cases. The question is there's the cost-benefit analysis that happens here, right? It costs so much to actually treat these things when they do affect people and they end up being hospitalized in long-term care facilities. How do we start to treat them earlier so it doesn't end up costing as much and so people are healthier?
Well, that is the key. So, I mean, I just want to address, before I even get to that, I just want to mention that healthcare is expected to increase next year, and inflation is at a 40-year high. So I do expect it to drive up medical costs over the next year. But there is a lot that can be done to reduce the costs and to treat people earlier. So, I mean, benefit plans can do a lot. I mean, what you could do is really promote using lower cost settings. You could do things like promote the use of walk-in clinics and urgent care centers for non-life-threatening acute care needs. Anytime a patient is using a hospital-owned facility for care, they generally pay more for services. So there's many times it may be the only and best option, but there's capabilities and access for alternative care centers, and they've grown tremendously in the past decade. And I think with the pandemic, there's been a lot more promotion. You know, there's been a lot more access to just care outside of the hospital. So the outpatient care in general has just been promoted tremendously.
And those poor, I say these poor urgent care centers, who over the last year have just been flooded with patients for COVID tests. I mean, we certainly have to figure something out so they're not bursting at the seams. Hey, Eileen, you mentioned that inflation is causing the price of healthcare to go up. We're going to see open enrollment, I think, for a lot of companies in the near future. Are we going to see sticker shock as employees at many of these companies when we start to see how much more our premiums are going to go up?
It depends on the plan sponsor. I mean, I think the plans should expect, on average, and we've seen this in our healthcare cost trend survey. So the survey basically is showing that medical plan costs are expected to increase at an annual rate of 7 to 8% in 2023. Now, we've seen that trends were actually, they had gone down significantly because people were deferring care. And now we're seeing between the inflationary environment and people actually using services, and now there's been an uptick in services. I think we're seeing that they're going up a lot. That said, it's not at the same level as what we're seeing for inflation. Inflation, I would think the medical care price inflation has actually gone up just in general. For overall consumer goods, and medical price is probably a little bit behind, and it's behind because of timing of provider contracting and commercial plans. So I think that it's embedded in those rates to some extent, but it's probably going to increase over the next couple of years.
You know, I wonder what the right conversation is to be having at this point: healthcare and the costs to society, to individuals, to companies, just to the economy. We've been talking about this for years, Eileen, and I do wonder, you guys are looking at how inflation is impacting healthcare costs. I mean, should we be looking at something like, and I talked about NCDs at the top, I mean, NCDs, which touch so many of our lives, either directly or through people we know, is there something that we can think about in terms of lifestyle preventive care? So maybe the question to be asked is, you know, how can preventive care impact healthcare costs? Is there a smarter conversation where we have to turn things upside down in how we approach healthcare, where we would get a better outcome in terms of quality of life as well as when it comes to the cost equation?
I mean, definitely, and there's definitely opportunity with preventive care. I mean, I think we've seen even with the pandemic that there were a lot of people who didn't take their preventive care screenings, and there are people that are now getting diagnosed with late stage cancer. So preventive care just is always a smart thing to do in general. And there's any opportunity you have to get to care sooner is always going to catch things earlier and avoid high cost claim outcomes. So that's definitely a smart thing to do.
All right.
And so doing that will just prevent a high cost claim and improve outcomes early on.
How sticky are we? Only have 20 seconds left, Eileen. But how sticky are healthcare costs? Like, do they come down or do they just stay high if they go higher?
There's sticky as a plan sponsor is in terms of managing their costs, and there's lots that can be done to do that. And so I think, plan sponsor really needs to look at their data to understand what is driving their costs. Mm. And using their data, they can come up with effective strategies to mitigate increases.
Well, great to check in with you. Eileen Flick, Senior VP, Director of Health Technical Services at Siegel. They're an employee benefits and HR consulting firm. She joins us via Zoom from Bayshore, New York.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, folks, we know getting back to work for the most part, DC back in swing, and that leads us to a Bloomberg Business Week story about the massively popular video app owned by a Chinese company. We are talking about TikTok and its charm offensive around its loudest critics.
You could just call it like addicting, like cigarettes.
It is. What's that? TikTok.
TikTok.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean,
WhatsApp was the last segment.
Exactly. I mean, in a sense, Facebook wishes it would have, been able to snag TikTok instead of WhatsApp, but that's an entirely different story. Joining us, we got Josh Brustein, technology editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the phone from New York City. Joshua, good to have you with us this afternoon. We're also going to be hearing from Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, from our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Joshua, I want to start with you, as you edited this piece by Alex Branca and Emily Birnbaum. If people haven't been following the TikTok saga, just explain what has Republicans, Democrats, and then tech critics so concerned about the ownership of the app.
Sure. So as you said, TikTok is a really popular social video app, competitor to a lot of the US-based social media apps, Instagram, Facebook, and so on. And in addition to kind of the general distrust of all tech products that work like this and questions about, how people are using them, whether the algorithm is manipulative, there's the added twist that TikTok is owned by a Chinese company and thus raises a lot of questions, suspicions about its connection to the Chinese government. And so lawmakers and others have questions about, what kind of data on U.S. users is ending up on servers in Beijing, how these algorithms might be furthering Chinese government political priorities, and just generally kind of tapping into that increased hostility between the U.S. and China.
All right. So Joshua, breaking down some of the concerns there. Joel Weber, I feel like we've seen this playbook before. Company gets in trouble, sends crew down to D.C., spends money, talks to lawmakers to try and fix things.
Sounds familiar, right? Tech company. Most of those are U.S. based, so this one's a little different.
That's true.
And that is, I think, part of the TikTok challenge here is like, how do you actually thread this needle and go on this charm offensive? But then as the story explores, the charm offensive is only directed at certain people. There's other people that the charm's definitely just not going to work on. And so they're just like steering entirely around them. But Josh, the other thing to kind of mention here is actually the scale of the lobbying ambitions, because I think that's the other important part here, Carol. It's like there's like an ROI here where I think TikTok looked at it and was like, we kind of need to show up, but maybe not show up for like a decade. Like, Facebook is just like entrenched.
Maybe go to some football games, hang out.
So Josh, talk to us about that strategy, because it does look like it's been very tactful, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that TikTok is a much younger company than Meta and some of the other Silicon Valley companies that are getting into trouble. So it's been scaling up. It's been scaling up pretty rapidly. They spent about $2.1 million on lobbying in the last period, which that's, I think, the year to date. Or no, I'm sorry, that's the second quarter. And, you know, that's not Meta scale, but that's pretty significant. And I do think that the interesting thing is, while they didn't say, the company doesn't say this on the record, part of the reporting in this story is that the company kind of realizes there are certain people that it just has no chance of convincing. And it's saying, you know, meeting with Josh Hawley or meeting with some of the other kind of especially strident critics, there's just no margin for us there. And so we're going to focus on trying to get someone to listen to our story. And maybe there's just going to be people who won't do it at all.
So what's this potentially look like, Josh, in D.C.? Like, I mean, it could have one outcome if Democrats stay in power. It could be another if they lose seats and things go to the GOP. What kind of, do a little game theory for us. What does it look like?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to watch here. Number one is to watch CFIUS, which is the interagency panel that looks at foreign investments that might have national security implications. You all might remember that there was a CFIUS review started in the Trump administration looking at TikTok's connection to the Chinese government and whether or not ByteDance, their parent company based in China, should have to divest TikTok entirely. We do have some reporting that the company is nearing a deal with CFIUS that would allow it to not have to completely divest itself, not completely separate from ByteDance. So that would be a good outcome for them. It's a little bit less tied to partisan concerns. And in terms of what happens in November, if you see Republicans take over, they just, the most harsh critics are coming from the GOP side. So I do think that for TikTok, just in terms of the public drubbing, a Republican victory might mean more of that.
What's the worst case scenario, Joshua, here? I mean, you can't really ban it, could you?
Well, if the CFIUS decision goes in a way that isn't kind of as indicated it seems to be going, and they did have to fully divest, I mean, that could be pretty disastrous.
Hmm.
There's also some discussion, the Biden administration looking at an executive order which could, depending on its wording, severely restrict the amount of data on U.S. citizens that a Chinese-owned company could collect, a social media company. They all collect a lot of data. We don't know what that executive order would look like, but that could also be a pretty serious threat. So I think those are two things in the near future to watch out for.
I think the CFIUS thing is totally the elephant in the room, because if they had to divest this or you know, end up to another ownership or something, you know, like that would just be, you go from being number one to something else.
I know a company that would really like that if that happened. Yeah, it's a company.
It rhymes with?
Yeah, it rhymes with Facebook or Meta Platforms. Yeah.
I believe they're known as Meta.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry. And I guess what would happen is what has happening now for a lot of geriatric millennials like myself, which is all the TikToks you end up seeing are the ones that are on Instagram that people repost there.
Oh my God. We're living in odd times. All right, we got to run. Joshua Brustein, technology editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. I just love going to the congressional football game, though, man. This is how it works.
Hail Marys.
Hail Marys, indeed. Yes. And that, of course, was the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Jill Weber. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel has become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Did you just say Disney's shutting down?
Yeah, Disney, we're just getting news that Disney is shutting its Florida theme parks tomorrow and Thursday. This is Hurricane Ian bears down on the state.
Yeah, certainly makes sense to be careful and obviously mid what is expected to be a pretty rough storm. All right, let's get to it. Certainly been a rough year when it comes to the market, certainly if you're trying to be bullish, because it's certainly been one for the bears. Jimmy Lee is founder and chief executive officer at Wealth Consulting Group, $2.9 billion in assets, roughly under management. Once again, joining us on the phone from Las Vegas. Jimmy Lee, how are you?
Great, how are you?
You're great, Jimmy. Do you still have $2.9 billion in assets under management?
Are you growing those AUM?
Well, we're trying our best.
What's tricky about this market environment?
You know, it's a very tough time right now, as we all know. There's a lot of confusion out there amongst investors. And with the, I think it's really about yields and how high interest rates are going up. And as we know, everybody's trying to predict, what the Fed's going to do. Are they really going to do what they say? And are we going to have the Fed funds rate go up another point and a quarter? And if that were to happen, is it going to be too late in terms of a potential for any kind of a soft type landing? And will we cause a really bad economic downturn? So I think that's what the debate is right now. Obviously, the market, the S&P 500 is teetering on the June lows. And so the next few days, I think, will be important, not just for equities, but also for fixed income.
So, Jimmy, we love talking to you for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because you're talking to clients all the time. And I'm wondering what your email inbox looks like right now. You know, what's happening? Is the phone ringing off the hook? Are people concerned? What are your clients saying?
I've got some great stories for you. So, I've been in the business since 1995. So for over 27 years, I have some clients that I still work with today that were invested with me. The dot-com bubble back in, 2000 to 2002. A lot of clients that were invested through the financial crisis, 08, 09. And then I will say that there are a few clients that I have personally that I work with that I've only been working with for the last few years that are expressing a lot of nervousness and literally over the last day or two. And so, I think there are, that type of anecdotal evidence, and I'm sure I'm not the only advisor that is having that type of experience. And so what I'm trying to point out is that the investors that have experienced declines much bigger than what we're going through today, because at right now at 24, 25% on S&P, it's not even a typical bear market yet, right? But I think that some people that don't have as much experience are starting to capitulate a little bit. So I think we're somewhere between, maybe not panic quite yet, but we're getting close to that emotional, behavior curve where people start to wanting to sell. And so I think it's really important, and we've been telling all of our advisors recently that to double up on all the communication with existing clients. And for our business, it's also a great time to go out and find new people that need some guidance.
When you say it's not a typical bear market, What, because of all the bouncing around or what?
Well, when you get a typical bear market, I mean, the S&P is down a third or more. Yeah. So we're not even close to that yet. And I'm not saying that this can't turn into that. And I think that's what the debate has been, whether if we go into a recession, that bear market's going to look more like a third or more, right? And so is that what's going to happen? And I've been on the side of I'm hoping it doesn't happen. I think that the consumer is still strong. But, you know, the Fed's trying to regain some credibility for not increasing interest rates sooner. And if they're going to be bullheaded and just kind of destroy the economy at the same time. And we're starting to see some ripple effects, right, worldwide mm-hmm. with interest rates in different places. I think in places like, you know, Italy and the UK, it's more about sovereign issues versus what's going on here with the Fed. But, you know, we're seeing yields pop in the UK at levels that we haven't seen before in a very long time. Here in the U.S., I can't remember when we had a 4%, you know, short-term interest rate for cash. And also, I can't remember when I really believed that buying bonds were a good opportunity. So we've actually added to our
Jeffrey
duration.
Dunlack is finding some interest in that.
Yeah, well, we added to duration on our bond portfolios, too, recently by adding some treasuries in the 7 to 10-year maturity range.
Interesting. If you said it's a good opportunity right now to actually provide guidance to newer clients, newer customers, are you getting new money in this environment?
Absolutely. I mean, for us as advisors, money's always in motion during times like this. So
how are you deploying
during the pandemic? Well, we're dollar cost averaging. So in my notes, that's one of the things that we're still going back to the old fundamentals, right? Some things that have always worked. So if you got dry powder, I wouldn't try to predict today to be the market low. But adding at today's levels, if you're long-term investors, if you have a three-year time horizon or longer, is a very smart thing to do. If you're a retiree and you're being forced to sell your investments at a loss because you need to spend on, I think you should go interview a new advisor because you should have a strategy in place that doesn't, you know, force you to do something like that. So a lot of advisors have, you know, reserve accounts set up for spending for retirees. And so I think it depends on the type of investor you are, but certainly for people that are trying to accumulate wealth, these are good times.
You, in your notes that you shared with our producers and our team, you said, you reminded us that on September 22nd, we got a market signal where over 60% of American Association of Individual Investors survey were bearish. In previous readings, when this happened, the average return 12 months later was 33% for the S&P 500.
Wow.
Okay, yeah, that's a pretty significant metric. How should we be reading it at this point where we're still waiting for full market capitulation? Just quickly.
Again, I mean, that's another sign. So when everybody's bearish, it makes me feel like it's not that easy to make money in the market, whether you want to short it or go long. So that statistic, I think, supports the view that, you know, we could get a pretty decent rally. Now, again, if we get some inflation reports that are less than expected before the year end and somehow Chairman Powell starts to change his language a little bit to make people think that they're going to pause sooner than we think today.
Yeah.
We could have a huge rally
right
after the midterm election. So that's what I would say. So be optimistic and think about the long term.
Which makes me wonder whether Charlie Evans, who talked to CNBC, like opened the door a little bit to that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether we should read too much into it. I think there's a lot of debate. Hey, Jimmy Lee, always good to talk with you. Founder and CEO of Wealth Consulting Group, roughly $2.9 billion in assets under management.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.